is an emeritus professor of chemistry at a university in upstate New York, and he is bringing a wonderful combination of lots of scientific understanding and knowledge and a great sense of humor, and you're going to love his talk. Paul Conant.
I hope in this presentation I can combine the very important big picture message of the need to move towards sustainability. And if it sounds too big, too remote, too global, I also have in this some intensely practical things that we can do as individuals, as communities, and so on. So as far as the outline of my talk, short introduction with the big picture, then how we should be maximizing resource recovery, and then the arguments against incineration, and then a quick comparison between incineration in disguise. What is being treated very seriously in this community is plasma arc technology, which is pretending not to be incineration. So watch out for that one. And finally, I shall be talking about successful alternatives around the world, many communities moving towards zero waste, and some concluding remarks. So let's start with the big picture. We're living on this planet as if we had another one to go to. Now, Mr. Bush thinks there is another planet. Mr. Bush's view of the planet is something like that, along with many other important leaders with a very short time scale. The planet is consumption, as taken from the cover of this book. And simply, you think about it, you can't run a throwaway society on a finite planet. You just can't do it. It's only a matter of time before you run out of resources, and I think the price we're paying for oil right now is an indication of what's going to happen later on. We're literally robbing our own children and grandchildren of their rightful share of these resources. This is colonialism in time. Landfills simply bury the evidence. Incinerators burn the evidence. And we have to face the real problem. And the real problem, in my view, is to fight overconsumption. Not only is overconsumption giving us a local crisis, but also a global crisis. And that global crisis is that since the Industrial Revolution, we have imposed a linear society on a planet that functions in circles. So our linear society goes something like this. We start with extraction of raw materials. We usually ship them halfway around the world. Then we manufacture something with them. And then we consume the products. And then we produce waste. A one-way system. And we stimulate this process with advertising on television. In America, every 7 minutes, we're told that we're hungry, we're thirsty, we're sick, we're too fat, we're sexually frustrated, and we need a new car every 7 minutes. Now, over-advertising produces over-consumption. And by the time a high school student in America has left school, they will have watched 350,000 TV commercials. They are programmed for life, an over-consuming lifestyle. The myth, of course, the American myth, is the more you consume, the happier you become. The reality is the more you consume, the fatter you become. And this, I think, a little bit of evolution says it all. Landfills simply bury the evidence. Incinerators burn the evidence. And we have to face the real problem. And the real problem, in my view, is to fight overconsumption. Not only is overconsumption giving us a local crisis, but also a global crisis. And that global crisis is that since the Industrial Revolution, we have imposed a linear society on a planet that functions in circles. So our linear society goes something like this. We start with extraction of raw materials. We usually ship them halfway around the world. Then we manufacture something with them. And then we consume the products. And then we produce waste. A one-way system. And we stimulate this process with advertising on television. In America, every 7 minutes, we're told that we're hungry, we're thirsty, we're sick, we're too fat, we're sexually frustrated, and we need a new car every 7 minutes. Now, Over-advertising produces over-consumption. And by the time a high school student in America has left school, they will have watched 350,000 TV commercials. They are programmed for life, an over-consuming lifestyle. The myth, of course, the American myth, is the more you consume, the happier you become. The reality is the more you consume, the fatter you become. And this, I think, a little bit of evolution says it all. The world has enough for everyone's need, but not for everyone's greed. Mahatma Gandhi, many, many years ago. Different times demand different questions. In the 20th century, we talked about waste management. And the key issue when I started in 1985 was, how do we get rid of our waste without damaging people's health and the environment? That was the big top agenda. Now we've reached the 21st century, the issue is not so much waste management as resource management, which demands that we handle our resources in ways which do not deprive future generations of some, if not all, of their use, their value. So in the 20th century, waste management, safety. 21st century, resource management, sustainability. Now, in my view, even if you made incineration, and by the way, the incinerators we're talking about today are not as horrendous as the incinerators that we fought in the 1980s. I don't think the problems have all been solved, but at least they're better. But my attitude is that even if you made incineration safe, you would never make it sensible or sustainable. It simply does not make sense to spend so much money destroying resources we should be sharing with the future. Now, the modern incinerator is attempting to perfect a bad idea. The bad idea, our task in the 21st century is not to find better ways to destroy discarded materials, but to stop making packaging and products that have to be destroyed. Now, Helen here is one of the great pioneers of extended producer responsibility, and that's what it's all about. Stop making these products that that have to be destroyed. And to get that lesson across, take these materials back. Take the packaging back, take the products back, and then you'll quickly realize that you can't make things to be. This kind of obscene photograph gives you some idea of the throwaway society. And if you can imagine that about the size of Texas, that's what the middle of the Pacific looks like. There's 10 times more plastic pieces now in that part of the ocean than plankton, if you look at the small pieces. It's absolutely sickening what we've done with something which seems so benign to us, this plastic. We play with it, seems non-toxic and lovely and convenient, and it doesn't cut us and all that kind of stuff. But we're literally cluttering the planet with throwaway plastics. Incineration is a technological answer to the wrong question. Waste, in my view, is not a technological problem. It's a problem of organization, education, leadership. I'm glad the councillors are here. Industrial design, extended producer responsibility. And eliminating waste is the key stepping stone in moving from a throwaway society to a sustainable society. And it's an exciting stepping stone because we're all involved. Every single human being makes waste. Every day we make it, and every day we are part of a non-sustainable way of living on this planet. With good leadership, we could be part of a sustainable way of living on this planet. And that's just the beginning, but it's the most practical place to start. Incineration is the final gasp of the throwaway society, and it will set back. If you go ahead and build these 3 or 6 incinerators, you will have wasted 25 years. It takes 25 years to pay for those things to operate it. And we don't have 25 years to waste. And we don't have that capital to waste. We should be investing it in genuine resource recovery. So how do we maximize this concept of recovering resources? I've simplified it here. We're talking about some of these, I mean, you're very familiar with these terms, source separation. Door-to-door collection, you're familiar with that. Composting, that is coming in. You're very familiar with the Blue Box program in collecting source-separated curbside recyclables. We need to do the same with composting. In fact, actually, we got it absolutely backwards. We should have started with curbside collection of organics because that's the only way you can get them clean so that you can compost them and get them back to agriculture. If you leave them in the residues, if you take out the recyclables, you're wasting one third of the waste stream, and it's the organics which make landfills so awful. They break down, they produce odor, they produce methane, which damages global warming and produces leachate. So the number one priority is to get the organics out of the landfill. And that's a program that is coming in here, and it's very important. Waste reduction initiatives. I should be saying a lot about that. There are little things that we can do. A little creativity at the front end can save millions at the back end. And I should be talking about what those waste reduction initiatives might be. Some examples. And then reuse, repair, and deconstruction. Deconstruction of buildings instead of demolition of buildings. And economic incentives. There are ways that we can tweak the economic system to drive it our way, the sustainable way, and not the throwaway way. The contribution that I'm making to this discussion is the notion of a residual screening and research facility. And I think we're very close now to getting perhaps the first of these built somewhere. And it may well be in Vancouver, I think, because there are leading politicians who are talking about academies. And that notion of academies, they're talking about academies to study water treatment. But I think the academies could also be used for waste treatment as well. And we need better industrial design and extended producer responsibility. Now, we're not going to end landfilling overnight, but the idea is to gradually ratchet down the amount of material that goes to landfills and get as close to zero as we can by 2030 without burning the materials. So one of the problems that we have is there's a lot of these things. And you start talking to the average politician about your, what is the solution, Dr. Carr? If you don't want the incinerator, what do you want? You don't want landfills, you don't want to say, what do you want? You say, well, I want a source separator, I want, the, you know, but sometimes this is hard work. You know, to do all these things that you're talking about here is a lot of work, a lot of effort. And we know what we're up against is one-stop shopping. We know that right now companies are going to Vancouver and saying, we will build you this great big wonderful facility. Just pay us $500 million and we'll build it for you. And once you cough up those taxpayers' money, you can leave it to the company to operate. And you just have one place to send the trucks to, either the landfill or this big incinerator. So this is one shop stopping. This has been designed by Eric Lombardi from Eco Recycle of Boulder, Colorado. This is what he's offering. He's going to communities and say, we will build for you a resource recovery park, which puts in everything I've more or less talked about. It will put in a materials recovery facility for the recyclables, another facility for the more difficult material to recycle, a center for reuse and repair, composting. And you need quite a large area for that. A section for construction and demolition debris. And then my favorite, the residual screening and research center. And an educational facility as well. And this, as I say, is being marketed now. He's got a price on it. And what he will do, and what others will do, I mean, he's not the only person, but what others will do is they will organize for the community putting all the modules together. So you say, yes, I'd like a resource recovery park. And I think Vancouver would have some wonderful sites for these facilities. Now, key then is that we've got to move from the back end of this problem, the back end of waste management, to the front end of resource management. That's a really important thing, moving from the back end to the front end. And I'm going to come back to that several times. So we need three things to maximize resource recovery. We need industrial responsibility at the front end, we need community responsibility at the back end, and by the way, we know we can get there. The people are not the problem. I have yet to go to a country where the systems are laid on for door-to-door collection, source separation, that the citizens have failed. Don't know of it. In fact, usually when you lay on the pilot schemes, the other communities are complaining because they don't have it. And we need good leadership to bring those two together, community responsibility and industrial responsibility. This is so important because for years and years and years, communities have performed somersaults to deal with all the crap that industry willy-nilly throws at them. They suddenly decide that they're going to have squeezable ketchup bottles, for God's sake. Absolutely, totally unnecessary. But one day we go to the supermarket, and the only kind of ketchup that we can get is in a squeezable ketchup bottle. And so now the councillors have said, well, what do we do with squeezable ketchup bottles? I mean, you can only do it so many times. So we got to say no to industry. No, 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 no. We've got Helen here. She's going to stop you. If you make squeezable ketchup bottles, you're going to get them back. If you make glass ones, we recycle the glass. Moving towards sustainability is the greatest challenge after we stop fighting each other in wars. This is going to be the greatest challenge to, and it's going to need good leadership. And quite frankly, we've got to say to these guys, look, if you don't want to lead us, if you don't want to fight for sustainability, no hard feelings, not personal, just retire. Let somebody young come in who is prepared to fight for this. We need design for sustainability. Right from the beginning, you design with two things in mind. One, I've got to sell this product, otherwise I'm going to go bankrupt. So I've got to sell it to the present. But I've also got this extra imperative. I've got to share the materials with the future in some way. Whatever way we're going to do it, you've got to share with the future. That's the design. We need clean production. Half of our problems is we're having to deal with lead and cadmium and mercury and arsenic and fluorine and chlorine and bromine, all these toxic elements that are in these products. And then when we're left with them, we don't know what to do with them. And there was at one point when it was costing more for the community to deal with the mercury batteries than the companies were getting paid for the mercury batteries in the first place. But that's changing. The battery companies have by and large phased that mercury out. And then finally, we want extended producer responsibility. And I've got two great examples to illustrate that. One is with packaging, and it's Canada. For over 50 years, you've had a tremendous example. The Canadian, actually I've said Ontario, but it's bigger than that. The Canadian beer industry has been using refillable glass bottles. Each, there, 98% of these are recovered in Ontario. Each one goes around 18 times. It's 11 cents cheaper per serving to use a reusable glass bottle than a disposable one. So the companies are saving money. And in Ontario, 2,000 jobs involved in the collecting of these bottles, handling these bottles, washing these bottles, and so on. So it's a job creator. And finally, there's no cost to the municipality. None. No community in Ontario is collecting beer bottles, recycling beer bottles, composting beer bottles, burning beer bottles. No. The beer industry has done it all themselves. They've internalized their packaging costs. And what we're dealing with is hundreds of corporations that are externalizing their packaging costs with throwaway packaging, throwaway plastic, and so on. Okay, now a product. The Xerox Corporation in Europe is recovering old copy machines from at least 16 different countries, taking them to huge warehouses in the Netherlands, which I visited. Very impressive operation. There the machines are stripped down. They reuse some of the parts, recycle the materials if they can't reuse the parts, and this is saving them $76 million a year. The message to industry, waste is the visible face of inefficiency. If you make less waste, you're more efficient, you will save money. You will save money on reducing production costs and also on disposable costs. They had no idea that they would save that amount of money. So there's a great message to industry. Do it right, you'll save money. Quaker Oats Canada will tell you that. Interface Carpets in Belleville, Ontario will tell you that. Hewlett-Packard will tell you that. Fuji will tell you that. And on and on and on. The more progressive companies are already into zero waste. Community responsibility begins with source separation. This is the magic machine. These are the magic machines. These are the things which make waste, and these are the things which can unmake waste and keep those resources in circulation. It's not difficult. And you talk about separation, it's far more complicated the way you handle the washing up than what you ask for asking. Recyclables in one container, compostables in another, residuals in another. That's simple. Think of all knives, forks, spoons, cups, plates, saucers, saucepans, frying pans, all the things you have to separate after washing up. We don't have nervous breakdowns with this. What about the clothes? What about the clothes? You take the clothes out.
I've got to separate the shirts and the socks and the underpants. Oh, I can't do that. Please, Mr. Westinghouse, give me disposable trousers and shirts so that I can wear them once and flush them down the toilet.
No, we only do that with diapers. And it costs us $2,000 to get a baby through diapers. So we have the three container system, one for the compostables, one for the recyclables, one for the residuals, and we have to minimize what that residual fraction is. Three ways: waste reduction initiatives, reuse, repair, and deconstruction, and economic incentives. Let's look at these one at a time. Waste reduction initiatives. In Ireland, they put a 15-cent tax on plastic shopping bags. In 1 year, they reduced the use of those shopping bags by 92%. And the other 8% is put 12 million euros into their waste fund. Nobody believed that was going to happen. In communities in Australia, they've banned plastic bags, and now communities all over the world are either banning them or taxing them. Italy. Italy has supermarkets now which allow you to refill shampoo bottles, detergent bottles, some wine, water, milk. Think of that. If you have a shampoo bottle, high grade, hard, heavy-duty plastic. You could refill that. That one bottle can go round and round and round and round. A little creativity at the front end saves millions at the back end. That's it in Italian. Okay. Reuse, repair, and deconstruction. This is the most valuable item in the waste stream. Furniture, appliances, lumber, building materials. Here's one of the great leaders in reuse and repair. This is Dan Knapp, Dr. Dan Knapp, and his wife Mary Lou Deventer. A fantastic operation. It's been going for over 30 years in Berkeley, California. They're now grossing $3 million a year with this material. They've created about, I think, 30 full-time jobs with really good benefits. Here is a breakdown of the discarded materials in the Los Angeles waste stream. This is the new word for waste, discards. Reuse, only 2% of the waste stream, the discard stream, but it's the most valuable item there. Burlington, Vermont. Recycle North, 27 employees, gross income over 700,000, offers an excellent model. I have a videotape of this. And here are all these other reuse and repair operations. And that videotape is Burlington, Vermont here. Not only do they recover the reusables, but they also have a job training program where they take people off the street, teach them to repair. They can choose large appliances, small appliances, electrical, electronic. And after 6 months, they get a certificate if they pass, and then they help them get a job. So there's job training. They also have a system whereby really poor people are given coupons which they can cash at the sink. They can get their essential furniture, etc., from this reuse and repair operation. And they also have got deconstruction. That's all illustrated on the videotape. AmericanHealthStudies.org. You go to that and you can access all these videotapes. They're all up there now through Google. Isn't that wonderful? You don't have to send the darn things out anymore. Just click on a button and there they come. And you'll have fun if you go there, because you'll see a videotape of me in 1988. Waste management as if the future mattered. And not much has changed. Oh, I've changed. Okay, economic incentives. The idea here is that all of this is covered in the tax structure, but you have to pay a surcharge for the residuals. You're trying to say, look, if you don't want to pay that surcharge, and you make sure that everything's reused that can be reused, or make sure you buy recyclable materials and make sure you do the composting and so on. And that has been very effective. So now, after all of that, we're down to the residuals, the rest of the residuals. Our current failures, poor separation, poor purchasing, poor industrial design combination. Now, this is where we get to the key difference between the current plan, which would incinerate that. If you incinerate it, you'll make those residuals disappear. And that would make the plastic throwaway industry very happy and some other people very happy. It doesn't make me happy. To maximize resource recovery and move towards zero waste and sustainability, we need to make these residuals very, very visible. How do we do that? We build a residual screening and research facility. Residuals mustn't be allowed to go directly to the landfill or to the incinerator. But to a residual screening and research facility, it can either be built in front of the landfill, as we have in Nova Scotia, or at the end of the resource recovery park. With such a long transport system to Cache Creek landfill, but I know you have other landfills, but for those who are sending it to Cache Creek, then it would make sense to have your residual screening and research facility at your resource recovery park located locally, rather than having it at the landfill. So there it is again. Now, this is what they have in Nova Scotia. The residuals come in, the bags are open, the materials are put on long conveyor belts, paid workers, well protected, pull out more recyclables, big bulky items, corrugated cardboard and so on, more toxics, a deposit containers, and the dirty organic fraction is not touched. It gets to the end of the conveyor belt, it is shredded, and goes into a second composting operation, not to make a product to sell because it is contaminated, but to stabilize it so that when eventually it goes to the landfill, either as cover, it doesn't break down to produce all the methane. And I'm getting rather hot, so I'm going to take my jacket off. It's stabilized. That's the idea. But I want something more than that. I want a research center which literally studies these non-toxic, non-biodegradable fractions. And this research screening facility is the key link now between community responsibility and industrial responsibility. Because essentially what we're down to is the stuff the community couldn't handle. And with this research, what we then say, having captured the high ground, we then say to industry, look, if we can't reuse it, if we can't recycle it, if we can't compost it, and for God's sake, we've tried like crazy to do it, then you shouldn't be making it. You've got to be better. And we shouldn't be buying it for that matter, but you shouldn't be making it. That's the imperative for the 21st century. Now let's elaborate on this a little bit more. The resource recovery park, what does that do? We're trying to maximize material recovery, maximize job creation, there's a lot of jobs here, maximize sustainable businesses which are using these materials, maximize profits. This is capitalist for zero waste. This is what Eric Lombardi described. We're capitalist for zero waste. And you've got that residual screening and research facility, which could become the Institute for Zero Waste and Sustainability. But the important thing is it will involve professors and students at the local university who will treat this as a laboratory. The best way to study the future of a society is to study its waste products. Study the waste products. Study our failures. And of course, there's many things that they can do, some simple. A better capture rate. There's some things that will show up here which shouldn't have done because we haven't educated the public well enough. So you've got to go back, improve the education. These students will be looking around the world for all the initiatives for reducing waste at supermarkets and so on. They would find out everything about that. They would increase extended producer responsibility. They would have many examples of that, of companies of all different sizes that are going along with the program. Local uses for some materials. Better industrial design. Let me tell you the one result of something that happened in Italy. A little community called, well not so little, Capannari near Lucca in Tuscany was the first community to declare zero waste. And they started this kind of approach. Not with fancy buildings, but just, they studied the residuals. And the three items that were there was the top item in the residuals was leather and rubber. So could they find local uses for it? The second item was diapers. And the third item was kitchen waste. So obviously the kitchen waste demanded improved capture rate, better education. Diapers, oh, what can you do with diapers? So they are. You've now got reusable diapers, we've always had them, but now they've got fancy ones which have got a heavy grade duty plastic outer lining, very easy to use Velcro strips or buttons, and then all you do is take the paper and the poop and flush it down the toilet and use it again. Now they've gone one step further. They've got the local pharmacies to newborn babies get these, the first one for free, introduce them the friendly way. So here's a good example of where doing a little bit of research has changed something. Now, the dirty organic fraction then goes forward, and it could go either, in my view, there's two ways. You could either send it to anaerobic digester, or I rather favor these long rotary kilns, which are used in manufacturing of cement, but they can also, with no temperature, you can also use them as a rotating bioconverter. You put the dirty organic fraction, you can have that rotating for 2 or 3 days, all the odors are gone. You can then put it, the stuff into a shed in the windrow system. And I've seen this in Perth, Australia, and I saw it in St. Petersburg, Russia. And then the material is stabilized. There's no odor outside this facility. There's no odor from the rotary kiln. There's no odor from this enclosed system. And then the low grade, possibly you might find low grade uses for this, if nothing else, landfill cover. And in the current plan, you might have to export.